Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. Welcome back to the show. As someone who has spent a good deal of time in Ireland, I can tell you it's one of the wettest places on earth. This year in March and April, it rained nearly every day, some days nonstop. And for those Irish immigrants who went to the United States, it must have been exceedingly strange to find themselves in such dry environments of the American West. The American West is just a complete contrast to the island of Ireland, and here I'm thinking about places like North Dakota, which I'm also very familiar with now. Places like North Dakota are so dry that most homes come with built-in humidifiers, and that's only one example, perhaps a trifling one, when compared to the other socio-cultural differences that Irish immigrants in the U.S. faced. But it's a useful comparison, if only to illustrate the changes wrought by their displacement. Today we're exploring the lives of Irish immigrants who came to the United States and took up mining, either as laborers or as owners. We're also going to look at how the industry was shaped by this group. To help me, I'm joined by a fellow graduate of University College Cork, Dr. Alan Noonan. Alan is currently based in Cork, at least temporarily, it would seem. I think he's moving to the United States soon. But it has made organizing this discussion rather easy because we're in the same place at the same time. But more importantly, Alan has won the prestigious Glucksman Government of Ireland Fellowship, which took him to NYU in Manhattan, and he's also the winner of the Washington, D.C. Library of Congress Kluge Fellowship. He is historian in residence at Cork City Libraries, and I am delighted to welcome him to the show. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you on. Your book is about the Irish in the U.S. mining industry during the Gilded Age. And I wanted to get to some of the people that are in your book, because I think some of them are really fascinating. But first, I wonder if you could say something about the industry to try and set this up for listeners. What was mining like in the mid to late 19th century, and how does it change from then until the 1920s?
I suppose mining, above all industries, really, is the one that's kind of tracking the development of the United States, where the United States has industrialization occurring to it continuously. It's this expansion of territory. Mining really is tracking the development of America itself. So in the mid-19th century, you have the 49ers, the Argonauts, the gold rush out to California. And that rush is propelled by this sort of frenzy of gold hunting, of which the Irish form a big component, going out to California and then spreading into the interior as well. And there's various other gold rushes then that take place, but fairly rapidly what starts occurring is different forms of mining take over, notably sort of hard rock deeper mining, also hydraulic mining, and these require industrial machinery to sort of take advantage of the sort of processing, the finding of the ore, the gold, the precious resources that they're looking for. And again, when we're thinking about these mines, they start off relatively small, and then with the assistance of the railroad that's spreading out westwards as well as the 19th century kind of stretches on, that allows the advent and the arrival of heavier industrial machinery that allows these bigger mining towns to develop. And so by the 1870s, you're seeing these larger towns, these cities in effect, like Virginia City in Nevada, which is developing the Comstock Lode, one of the largest silver ores ever discovered. And the Irish form a major part of that town, partly because four of the owners of the main veins, the main mines that are being explored, are Irish or Irish-American. Four guys called Fairflood, Mackey and O'Brien. And they have a preference for hiring Irish people, whereas an awful lot of other mine businesses as well might be discriminatory, or they might be preferential towards Protestant hires from particularly Cornwall, who are considered the preeminent miners of the time, both because they had experience in the mines, a lot of Irish did have experience in the mines as well, but also because they're the archetypical or the sort of most hope for immigrant in America during this this period. You know, they're white, Anglo-Saxon, and they're Protestant.
That's fascinating. I mean, obviously, there's another factor here, which, so that's the history of the United States, but there's an Irish history to all this as well. What brings these people to the United States and to the West? I mean, we hear a lot about Irish Americans in Boston and New York on the East Coast, but the West is probably a story that's a little underbaked.
Yeah, that's true. I suppose when we think of industrialization in the United States, we kind of think of the exactly what you're saying, that East Coast, maybe even like the furthest we get with mining terms might be maybe the, you know, anthracite fields of Pennsylvania, where you have those Molly Maguire developments. But then you also have the steelworks and you have, you know, these larger sort of industrial cities. But the American West, most of the economy is not actually being driven by agrarian or agricultural sort of industry. It's actually being driven by industrial urban centers such as these mines, which are really providing actually the business for agriculture to establish itself, for trading towns to develop. And the Irish form a big part of these mining towns, primarily because if we think of the gold rush, it's the notices of this sort of fabulous wealth. And so people put a lot of money to try and get access to that and get access as well to the cheap land that's over there. And additional sort of factor then that starts occurring is these mining towns, they offer a very good initial wage to try and draw in workers. And then there's often conflict between the mining company as the years roll on and the mines start getting larger, or either play out. But there's conflict between the company and the workers. And often what occurs is the workers are under the leadership of emergent trade unions. Trade unions in America at this stage are a very, very new thing, and so are only being created. And the leadership of them is often drawn from the Irish. The Irish have this understanding of the importance of organization, the idea that if you don't come together, the companies are just going to be able to sort of exploit you and divide you. The way that they negotiate that sort of organization or that sort of in camp isn't in the ways that we kind of think of trade unions today. That's all sort of a developing idea. The idea that, you know, trade unions are reaching out to all workers, the idea that there is one cohesive working class is all a very distant idea in mid-19th century America. The other thing, I suppose, just reaching back into the earlier point, is that these mining towns and cities become huge drivers of employment and business, and also in the electrification of America. Butte was called the richest city on earth, the richest hill on earth in the late 19th century, early 20th century, primarily because it's a vast resource of copper. And when they first start exploring the mines of Butte, they're shocked by how rich the ore veins are. And when they send them over to process in Swansea, because the United States didn't have the processing facilities really to refine copper at this point, they're surprised as well, because they think that it's been refined once or twice when it gets over back over to Europe. But in fact, it actually hasn't. That's just how rich the ore was. And one of the biggest people in Butte then is Marcus, Irishman, who has a preference for hiring Irish people. So the Irish realize that there is this preference for hiring them. They realize that there's this opportunity for a high wage. And while the costs of that are also fairly severe, industrial mining in the United States had a very high fatality rate and was incredibly dangerous work. And we can kind of get into the reasons for that later on. But more importantly, the Irish realized that it was sort of a give and a take. They were able to get high wages. They were able to create these communities and support their families. But the cost was often a very shortened lifespan for themselves, for the miners who were working in the mines, and the women, of course, as well, living in these towns who were cleaning the clothes of the miners were often also inhaling the dust as well and suffering from the ill effects of that. And I talk a little bit about that in chapter four, where I'm talking about Virginia City and the effects that this had on the health of the community itself. But still, again, it's that opportunity that really draws them to these places, and they hear from each other. This news network that is kind of created in the 19th century is through letters and newspaper accounts of this place doing quite well. Relatives would write to each other saying, you know, there is the chance for Irish people to get a good job here, to get this high wage over here, you know, come over. And so this chain migration pattern starts happening. And often it's multi-generational. People think of people maybe getting straight onto the ferry in Cove or the transatlantic boat and heading over to America. But sometimes it was actually people left Ireland. They would work in England or Scotland for a while, even in the mines in different places. And then they would travel over to the east coast of America, maybe Pennsylvania or Michigan there, the Keweenaw Peninsula. And then they would head further west. Always in their minds was, where was the opportunity presenting itself?
One of the biggest opportunities is Virginia City. A lot of what you've said is talked about the laboring side of things, but actually what your book is so brilliant at showing is that there's an owner side to this as well. Irish Americans were owners. We did a show back, maybe 2 years ago now, about George Hearst, the Silver King, who was obviously an owner of part of the Comstock Lode. And in that show, we completely overlooked the Irish. There is an Irish-led venture in Comstock. I mean, you mentioned Marcus Daly. He also worked at Comstock. So what have we missed about the Irish as owners?
So the Irish as owners are a story that sort of bucks the trend of 19th century stereotyping of the Irish as simply poor immigrants. They weren't just poor immigrants. They were also able to access upper echelons of society, sometimes through strokes of luck, sometimes through being, you know, through their own contacts and uniting with each other, as in the case of Virginia City with Fair Flood Mackey and O'Brien. And those people come together both with the investments that they have in the mining and some of the resources that they've built up, and they develop a major competitor to Hearst. Now, what do they do with the mines that they've sort of created? Well, they have a little preference as well themselves for hiring Irish, whereas Hearst might have decided not to hire either Irish miners or, in particular, and this is kind of one of the key points, Irish mine bosses. The Irish mine owners had no problem with doing that. And when they are hiring Irish mine bosses, what I think is a fear in an awful lot of the Protestant mine owners' minds is that they're going to start unionizing, they're going to start organizing against us, against the management. And there was a belief that the mine bosses should always be on the side of the company. And implicitly then, when you're hiring Cornish or, again, like I said, Protestant mine bosses, that's sort of an implicit part of that agreement. Whereas the Irish, overwhelmingly Catholic, not always, but overwhelmingly Catholic, were seen in some way as distrustful. And again, because they would have much deeper connections then with that Irish labouring class, they might also be viewed suspiciously, whereas the Irish mine owners had no real sort of suspicion in that regard. And that's true later on in Butte. Butte, Montana, had an almost entirely peaceable 40 years of management and worker relationship, which stands in stark contrast to the rest of the American West. Virginia City is kind of a similar story. And then if you look at the other examples that I have in the book, it's totally different. You know, these areas in Idaho and the Coeur d'Alene mining region, or in Leadville in Colorado, have major labor confrontations and very bloody labor confrontations. Again, because management starts to see the workforce as adversaries, they start deploying those earlier 19th century tactics of infiltrating the workers' unions with Pinkerton or Thiel detective spies. And those records are relatively are fascinating. You hear the detectives' sort of accounts of the mine workers' meetings and what exactly was going on there. But again, I think that the emphasis that I give in the book is how important these ethnic factions are, be it, you know, Cornish, or be it Irish, or be it, you know, Chinese, or be it Italian, whatever the ethnic group was, those had major impacts both on culture, on the society, and on the workplace as well. And I suppose I tried to highlight that then by kind of talking about what was going on in the communities, how the communities related and worked with or worked against each other. And that, as I said, sort of spread into the workplace as well and affected the whole relationship, the whole working dynamic in the American West.
I think we should probably take a moment to celebrate what you do in the book in terms of your method and approach to showing the culture. The book has, you know, a number of songs, poems, folktales and stuff that kind of that come together to give evidence about what life was like for Irish miners. How did you find taking that approach to the historical narrative? Was it something that came easy, or was this something that required you visiting many more archives than you had originally intended to?
It was a long process. I felt a great sense of obligation as I kind of discovered in the archives that I went in, the remote archives that I went to, little bits and pieces of different parts of the stories. And an awful lot of these smaller towns, I know I've already spoken an awful lot about the bigger towns, but there are smaller concentrations of mines around the American West, dozens and dozens of them littered throughout the landscape, you know, in various locations. And in those smaller ones, I kind of talk about them in several parts of the book. I try and include one or two per chapter just to give an illustration of what the smaller mining towns and camps were like. But the stories of those places, their accounts were often scattered in different company records that could be in archives, either a local archive, or they could be in a state archive, or they could be in a university archive, or they could just be, you know, hidden away in some sort of weird personal collection. Like, there was a state park up in northern Idaho that just happened to have a series of letters written by this Irish priest who was living up by this one mining camp, and just totally random. They didn't have an archive collection, they just had this collection of letters kind of sitting there. And so it was quite difficult for the songs, poems and stories to be able to get to them. And that was a big struggle that I found, because it might be a little bit of a red flag for the future that while more and more historical resources are being digitized, which is a great thing that we're now able to access so many of those letters and documents online, we have to remember as well that an awful lot of documents and records are not going to be digitized, that they're not going to be out there. Either the local facilities don't have the resources to be able to store them, or they just, you know, it's just a collection of volunteers or something like that, or maybe even they're held in personal hands. And so as historians, I think we kind of need to keep in mind that we should be willing to still travel to the places that we're talking about and to explore maybe unusual, not necessarily rumors, but, you know, track down different avenues to find what exactly is going out there. The best suggestion that I heard when I was becoming a graduate student was the phrase, ask everyone. And I think that's very true when you're doing graduate research, or when you're exploring any sort of topic for further research, is ask everybody, even in the locality, in the area, you know, do you know anything about that? Because as a historian, we love archives, we absolutely adore them. But, you know, like I said, you might hear about some collection being held or squirreled away someplace else. So it was a long, arduous process, but one that I think the book was the better for trying to visit all of these remote places.
Well, Alan, I'm just going to share your own news. You're moving to the United States. It's almost like that story about Robert Caro moving to Texas to get closer to Lyndon Johnson's friends. I mean, you're right. You have to visit these places in order to know them, and that means spending a lot of time there. I was wondering about your point about religion and faith, and you mentioned that the Protestant owners were hiring Protestant bosses and Irish bosses were being hired by Irish owners. But how important is Catholicism to the culture of the laboring force in these Western states?
Yeah, religion is this, sometimes I think in labor studies, religion is set aside. There was a really good book that I reviewed for a journal called Redeeming Time, which kind of centralizes in Chicago the importance of religion in how workers sort of view their workplace and how they organize themselves. And very much my own work is sort of doing that to the workers that were arriving into the American West, these American West mining towns and 19th century industrial spaces were very much religiously active, religiously aware. It was not simply a faith to them as well. It was also a massive part of their culture. And so it's kind of strange thinking really in the 19th century as a nativist that the Irish arriving into the United States are going to jettison their religion, not necessarily because the idea that they could jettison Catholicism, but because their Catholicism was so deeply intertwined with their identity, with their community, the people that they hung out with, the family, the wives that they chose, the ways that they decided to live and organize themselves, you know, with the priests and the nuns being a big part of that community, the priests being involved in education and the nuns being involved in education and healthcare as well. And of course, the churches that they built everywhere. And all you need to do is still travel around the American West nowadays to these smaller remnants of gold mining towns or whatever mining that's going on. And often you'll see a Catholic church or the remnants of a Catholic church. And so, again, that sort of importance is not to be taken lightly and is central to the ways that they saw the world and the ways that they saw themselves as well.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that you're right. You can see those the remnants of that all over the West still. The other thing that I thought your book was really important and made a really deep impression on me was sort of obliterating some of the stereotypes that we might have about mining communities. You start your book with a story about Nellie Cashman, who is a female, and you really emphasize throughout the book the importance of women in mining communities. So maybe you could say a little about what role they played in these stories of labor and mining.
The stories in the American West that kind of focus on women in mining is almost always with the mining camps and with regards to sex workers. And that was a part of the story, an important part of the story. But often women were working either as domestic laborers more frequently than they were working as sex workers throughout the American West. And I suppose, you know, it's that element of sort of glamorization, sensationalization that goes on in any sort of historical account. You know, there are certain elements of the story that are focused upon that are picked up and really sort of echoes into the historical narrative. But for me, I thought that by leading with an example that sort of broke the stereotypical mining experience or the perception of the public of the mining experience in the American West, I thought that that might be useful as a sort of introduction. And when we talk about sort of these independent trailblazing women, there's several other that are sort of mentioned. You know, Belinda Mulrooney is another one. She ends up going up to Alaska. And of course, you know, the trade union organizers, Mother Jones, who is an organizer, trade union organizer, not just in the East, but also travels throughout the American West, organizing these distant mining campuses, and is at the Colorado labor war during that that sort of very vicious dispute there. Women being involved in different facets of the community. And I suppose for me, my goal in talking about these people and emphasizing about the women's lives in the American West is to show how they are foundationally important in the creation of these communities. And these communities, these mining communities, is kind of what the whole book is about, because when they are created and eventually peter out, because mining is a finite resource, eventually it either goes too deep or and becomes too expensive to exploit, or they just run out of the resource. And so those towns are abandoned. You know, even places like Virginia City, once a thriving town of over 50,000 people, once those locations are abandoned, what happens to the people who once lived there? Well, they join other mining communities if they have those skills for that area, or, you know, they diversify and live in different parts of the state. These communities keep getting recreated, even if they end. So, you know, you often have these communities form and then reform and then form and reform again and again throughout the American West, which is kind of an incredible story of the durability of those connections, both between families and between, you know, religious members and identity and culture. That draws them all together and allows the continuance of those, in particular, Irish communities throughout the American West in the late 19th and early 20th century.
So that's another thing that I love about the book, Alan, as well, is this sort of forming and reforming of communities. And in terms of religion and gender, we haven't talked about race, but I need to, because your book touches on this as well. The story of the Irish becoming white is a really fascinating one, and you do touch on that. So how is it that the Irish shed some of the racial tropes that they had earlier in the 19th century, but other groups, other communities, like the Chinese, for example, could not do?
Yeah, it's a great question. When we're talking about California in particular, you know, there's Carney living over there, and he really taps into that nativist attitude and really allies with the nativists in an effort to target the Chinese throughout California. In the rest of the American West, that movement is much less popular and much less sort of embraced by the Irish. There are certain anti-Chinese protests that take place, in particular in Leadville, Colorado, when Irish women working in the laundry business feel challenged by Chinese immigrants working in the laundry industry. And so they sort of rally to target the Chinese, and they tap into that sort of nativist idea and utilize it to their own ends. I suppose the ways that you kind of have to approach race during this point is that for the Irish, it's one of many terms that is used against them and used by them. And so for an Irish person in the American West, you know, they were Irish, Catholic, member of a trade union. They could have been the associate of, like, for example, members of the Land League as well, sending money back home to Ireland to even more radical Fenian organizations. There's a whole series of different associations that they can have, links that they have with different groups. And then, of course, you know, the label white can be put on them as well, although when and where they qualify for that requires all sorts of you know, added details of what is the context of the time. Do the local white, or, you know, we can use the term white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, accept that definition of the Irish as white, or do they refuse it? In other cases and contexts, you actually have alliances between the Irish and the Chinese, or the Chinese are in a preeminent position of power. That's relatively exceptional, but it does occur. And then there are other cases where the Irish ally with Italian workers or with Cornish who are more privileged. So there are ways to access these different sort of alliances and utilization of that sort of idea of race that's floating around America at that particular time is definitely something that they are understanding and that they navigate and that they deploy when they are able to. Sometimes, again, as I'm saying, it was deployed against them. And we have, of course, in mid-19th century, the Know Nothing Party. And there are certain organizations in the American West that I talk about as well, in particular the vigilantes, who could probably be described as similar to a white supremacist organization. You know, this certain branches of it definitely have an affinity for that. And they end up doing... They end up causing great harm towards either Native American groups or Chinese groups, and often they target the Irish as well. But it's a fascinating milieu of different identities and ideas floating around at the time, and race definitely plays a part in that. And the Irish, you know, understand that that is a factor in American society at this particular time.
Absolutely. We've also talked on the show before about citizen alliance groups and vigilante strike breakers, anti-labor organizations in general. I mean, the Irish miners in the West certainly face some of that. And in the East, you already mentioned the Molly Malones. Molly Maguires. The Molly Maguires were an East Coast secret society, though. I don't know, do they make it out to the West? But how do the Irish resist that anti-labor violence in the West?
The Molly Maguires, apparently, and this is again accusations, there is a chapter that I talk about in chapter 4 where there is an explosion in a mine in Colorado, and the management believe that there is some sort of secret society that the Irish are organizing, that it's the Molly Maguires out in the American West. And it turns out, no, there's no real evidence of it. And in actual fact, it could be the Pinkerton or Thiel detectives who are working for the mine company, who are kind of spreading this rumor. There's a kind of panic in the town. And there's definitely a general American fear of these secret societies, in particular, the Irish secret societies or the Italian secret societies. There's talk about the Black Hand as well, which is an Italian secret society, which does exist in certain groups and certain communities. But again, there's a hysteria about this this danger that, you know, they're going to take over. Now, there definitely are secret societies. We have to remember that the 19th century was awash with secret societies. The Freemasons, Masonic organizations. There's also a whole heap of benevolent fraternal organizations. The Masons are kind of different. They're the atypical secret society in that they're sort of this group that have strange rituals and they help each other in business and in commerce and things like that. And obviously they're fairly virulently anti-Catholic, but they set the tone for a whole series of other secret societies. For example, the Knights of Labor, which are a proto-trade union organization. But also then, you know, we have to remember that the Irish secret societies too are starting to spread. You know, you've got the Fenian organizations, you've got the Land League, which wasn't necessarily a secret society, but, you know, people wouldn't necessarily have been talking about it too much. They would have been sending back home to Ireland remittances for the organization. There would have been talks for various nationalist and nationalist leaders and things like that. Michael Davitt traveled around the American West as well. Douglas Hyde, for the Irish language, traveled around the American West. But anyways, I suppose my point was that there are all sorts of different secret societies in the American West at this point. So it's simply because an organization is a secret society doesn't necessarily mean it's malicious. For example, there's a group called the Benevolent Order of the Elks, and the group is in effect an insurance scheme for if somebody got injured or died in work in the mines in particular. And so all of these groups kind of spring up, and it's a secret society, but, you know, the one of the Irishmen who joins them, he writes in the Progressive Men of Montana, which is a little book that you can read online if you'd like at some stage, but he writes about the Benevolent Order of Elks. He says they're the best people on earth. BPOE, excuse me, Benevolent Protective Order of Elks. I got an acronym wrong, but they love their acronyms back then. And if you ever want to see the prevalence of those secret societies in these towns in the American West, just take a look at the city directories. And at the start of the city directories, you'll have the people who were in charge of the town. You know, you'll have the various sheriff's office, the firefighters. And then underneath that, you'll have churches. And then just below that, you'll have secret societies and the times and days of the week that they're meeting. So the secret is not necessarily as secret as we might think. You know, they advertise themselves too. But yeah, they were a big part of this sort of paranoia, hysteria about the Irish. The idea that, you know, these people who are speaking differently, who are of a different religious affiliation, who have their own sort of friends, contacts, links, who don't really, for want of a better word, mix with wider society, kind of keep to themselves or do their own things, I should say, that they are involved in some sort of clandestine activity. And of course, you know, the loyalty of Irish Americans and the Irish arriving to the United States is much written about, much story. The Irish arrived with a sort of almost innate loyalty to the idea of the United States and talked about that quite frequently. So suggesting or thinking that they're, you know, this secret group that are trying to overthrow the United States for the Pope is faintly preposterous, or fairly preposterous, I should say, when you read the letters and documents of these actual Irish immigrants.
Yeah, this is they're more social clubs, and there's several ethnic groups that have the same, like you mentioned, the Knights of Columbus. But what I really liked about the book was that the clubbing that grew up around Irish communities also had a distinctive female influence. And I was just wondering, did the fraternal orders and clubs alleviate social isolation and fix some of the issues for the Irish, or did it perpetuate some of the issues that they had? I mean, not in terms of loneliness and isolation, but, you know, other problems that might have, you know, made the Irish seem outside of the mainstream American social network.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because, you know, it's a double-edged sword for the Irish. It definitely does provide this sort of social link, and in particular for women, that they're able to either be members of church organizations or be members of the Ladies Land League, for example, or even the female branch of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, the Auxiliary. But yeah, you're absolutely right. In effect, it's sort of twofold, because firstly, you're talking about concentrating these Irish people into their own social groups, which is great. And it's kind of what they want and what they hope for. That's absolutely true. That kind of makes them a target, definitely. But it also becomes a problem with the trade unions. When the Irish start establishing and organizing trade unions, you know, it would be the height of naivete to say, and it would be counter to the historical example as well, but it would be the height of naivete to think that they weren't going to think about their position within these mining towns and camps if they're in a position of power and influence within the trade unions. And often you see in the accounts by the detectives, the private detectives who were sent by the mine companies to investigate the trade unions, to see what exactly they're talking about, to see their activity. And of course, you know, obviously we have to take those sources with a pinch of salt, just make sure that it's kind of relatively grounded in reality. But the things that they're talking about strike me as very familiar. Like the Irish who are within a trade union in Leadville, Colorado, are talking about, you know, their fears of being betrayed by some of the Cornish miners who aren't necessarily fully joining the trade union or are kind of reluctant members of the trade union. And the Cornish are kind of suspicious of what the Irish are doing because they're in positions of leadership within the trade union, and the Irish are trying to bring in other ethnic groups into the fold. And often the discussion is like the Irish thinking like, well, we'll sort out those Cornish after the strike. I think that's probably correct. I think that the detective who was writing the reports there, and I kind of do it in, I talk about it in chapter 4, in the Colorado chapter, I think is well worth talking about, well worth looking at. But, you know, they're talking about their fears, their suspicions, and it can often be a problem for the trade unions then, because sometimes their fears lead them into confrontational decisions, when in fact it might have been a better option not to necessarily be so confrontational, or in some cases not to be goaded into a confrontation by the mine companies, who are happy to have and instigate instability. And that is something that we see in Idaho in the Coeur d'Alene mining region, where the mining company is actually encouraging the growth of anti-worker, anti-Irish organizations, nativist groups, and in effect sort of vigilante groups, to try and divide the community against itself so that their position is not threatened.
Yeah, and the thing that got me was that there were stooling Irish unions as well. And I don't know if that was the case in Idaho, but you mentioned in Chapter 4 some dueling Irish unions, and that really complicates life for the Irish, right?
You're absolutely right. Like any organization, you know, the first item on the agenda is the split. Now, it's not quite that bad in the American West, but of course there's confrontations between various branches of, you know, how radical are the trade unions over there? You know, what are their eventual goals? And of course, the confrontations between the industrial workers of the world, of whom many Irish are founding members, Father Haggerty, they even have a priest on their founding member board, an Irish born priest. They have Mother Jones, a whole series of other people. And then the Western Federation of Miners, who are a very powerful union across the American West. And so these battle back and forth, and, you know, there's accusations in the late 19th, early 20th century of various, you know, types towards them. The more radical ones are obviously more attacked as, you know, communists or, you know, dissidents or disloyal to America. You know, the IWW is one big union. That's their big hope, is that it's going to be a worldwide union of workers. And so that obviously is, you know, definitely something that is decried as a sort of disloyal to the United States and vaguely dangerous and radical to the whole democratic project. And of course, that's ramped up then during the Red Scare after the First World War. But definitely there's all sorts of divisions within it. The trade union organization, of course, is not one monolithic organization, and neither is the Irish community with regards to Irish politics. There were great amounts of remittances sent back home. But while a lot of them were sent to various Irish nationalist organizations or Irish relief organizations as well, particularly during the difficulties in the 1870s when there were crop failures in Ireland, the overwhelming amount of remittances were simply back to family members. Much of it to help them emigrate over to the United States as well. So family members following family members, relations or contacts following other contacts. But it's an awful lot of it that's sent home is just sent home to pay for the rent on the farm, or to pay for, you know, improvements in the life of the people who are living back home in Ireland. And so I suppose that needs to be borne in mind as well, that, you know, those are things that are foremost to people's minds.
Are there any characters in the book that you think straddle this period really well, as almost emblematic of the, well, your book covers the 1850s to the 1920. You know, Marcus Daly, we touched a little bit about him, James Mullaney, you know, are there any characters that you think really are emblematic of the period that you study here?
I would give the example off the top of my head, I'd probably lean towards Thomas Cruz. He was one of the last kind of gold miners, and his life, I think, was quite interesting. Like Marcus Daly, he was born in County Cavan in Ireland and emigrated over to America, became a placer hunter. So he's hunting around for gold deposits and looking to strike it rich one last time. Anyway, he's over in Montana, and Montana has some of the latter gold strikes as well, like Alaska. And he's hunting around the place for that sort of ore vein that will give him security. He's getting into his older age, so he's getting a bit older for this wandering mining existence. And he finally gets grub staked, which means that basically A shopkeeper decides to pay for his supplies to explore, and it's on credit. So now he's in debt, and he's kind of, this is his last grubstake, and he actually does manage to strike it rich. He finds what's called the Drumlummon mine, and he's very careful with this discovery. He holds onto it and develops it as much as he can himself before he finally finds financiers, and he holds on to 1/6 interest of the mine production. Now, unlike Marcus Daly, he doesn't retain total control over the mines. Marcus Daly had some business experience, which allowed him to sort of access that higher levels of finance, that higher levels of control. And so he became one of the copper kings of Montana and became a very powerful figure in both Montana and sort of history at that particular point. But Thomas Cruz takes a different line. He takes the money and sort of holds on to it, builds the Catholic cathedral up at Helena, and then kind of marries, supports his family, and he becomes this little bit of a, it almost feels like a thorn in the side for the Helena well-to-do community. Helena has the highest number of millionaires in the United States at this particular point per capita. And so it's an area where a lot of well-to-do, waspy sort of figures hang out. And there's this sort of Irishman who just managed to strike it lucky with this gold mine towards the end of his life. He gets this nickname, Colonel Tommy Cruz. And of course, he never served in the military or anything like that. But it was a title that was often given to those early sort of frontier explorer people. I have no recollection or account in any of the historical stories whether or not he really embraced that. But I will say that in the Progressive Men of Montana, which is the sort of mugshot history where they detail, you can pay a fee to have your story kind of talked about. Thomas Cruz does pay for his little section of the book, and his one obviously runs like 2 pages compared to other people's accounts, which is only like a single line. There's 4 columns to each page. Everybody else is kind of a column and a half, and his is like 9-10 columns. Anyways, he does talk about that Colonel Cruz, so maybe he did enjoy that. But there's also other stories that kind of come out of it in his life, where his daughter is the queen of the 4th of July, the Independence Day celebration that takes place in Helena. And I include a photo of her and the top of this sort of big sort of float as the queen of the parade. And I think that that is representative of that transition that takes place over his life, and that he has finally sort of accessed this level of respectability, probably brute forcing it through simply garnering an awful lot of money through gold mining. But I will also parallel the experience of his town of Marysville with the town of Butte, where an awful lot of Irish were hired in Butte, Montana. What ends up happening up in Marysville, and again, this is partly because Tommy Cruz doesn't have control of the mine employment. He leaves the mine management over to this company who have basically bought him out to develop it. That Marysville becomes increasingly influenced by nativist organizations. And so it's a relatively unfriendly place for actual Irish miners working there. Whereas Butte, with Marcus Daly directly having control over the operations of the mines, has a much larger Irish concentration. And Butte to this day still has a massive St. Patrick's Day parade every year. So just a little indication of, you know, the ways that these figures that, while, you know, they could be called captains of industry or the sort of bigger people in the business world, and they kind of locked into their position, right? So, you know, there was that element of it there too, but they definitely do have an influence. And there's about a dozen other people that I could talk about, but I think his life had a very interesting sort of course, the way that it sort of ran through the whole period that we're kind of talking about, from that gold exploring all the way through to sort of developing that industrial mines, and him becoming a big sort of figure within Montana and establishing a local bank, a state bank, I should say. And so, yeah, it's an interesting story. There's a lot of other people, I suppose, I could have picked. Michael Mooney is a very interesting figure as well. And when challenged to, sorry, I'll remember it quickly, but Michael Mooney's story, I think, is interesting as well, that he's organizing these trade unions over in America and is accused by another person who's actually George Daly. His father was Irish born, and he's accused of basically trying to take the entire American flag for himself, to take over the place. And Michael Mooney replies, he says, "I do not think I have the entire flag. I'm not entitled to that, but I do believe I am entitled to a small part of it." And I think that's a sort of good encapsulation of the way that Irish immigrants saw their place in American society. And one of the reasons why they sort of resisted so strongly when challenged in places like the American West.
I mean, I think both of those are really great stories. The photo of Marnie Cruz, Colonel Cruz's daughter, and that parade is super. And it makes me think I had no idea there was any Irish connection to it, because if you look at this photo, there's just American flags everywhere, women in white dresses, and obviously throngs of people on the streets of Helena. But it did make me think about this time period and the end of that hyphenated Americanism, and or maybe the general consensus that to be a hyphenated American was not a good thing as World War I was approaching. So what's happening in the West? Because certainly on the East, there's people talking about hyphenated Americanism and Irish Americanism or German Americanism as a bad word, and that you're only American. Is the same thing happening in the West as well?
Absolutely. And in actual fact, I think that the main battles for that hyphenated identity occur in the American West. You have the sort of solidification of what exactly it was to be Irish American. I definitely think that the Civil War was the forging place for the acceptability of Irish immigrants into the United States. There's a recent book, I think it's called Paid For by Blood or something similar to that, but a very good one where, you know, basically Irish immigrants dying in vast numbers during the Civil War is what allows them to sort of banish an awful lot of those suspicions in the mid-19th century, the nativist and the know-nothings ideas. But those ideas still persist. And Woodrow Wilson, traveling around the American West, he is over in Bisbee, Arizona, and he's facing down a series of miners. He's trying to rally support for the League of Nations. And obviously, because Woodrow Wilson was seminal to the involvement of the United States coming into the war on the side of Britain, the Irish miners were not a big fan of Woodrow Wilson in any way, shape or form. And, you know, they saw him as helping the old enemy, particularly with what happened in 1916, you know, what the Easter Rising in 1916 in Dublin. That has resonances over for the Irish American community as well. And so Irish American and German American miners are in Bisbee, Arizona. They start jeering Woodrow Wilson as he's speaking to the crowd. And Woodrow Wilson, he turns to the crowd, and in a moment of anger, he shouts, "I have often believed that any man carrying a hyphen in his name is carrying a dagger to stab into the entrails of our American Republic." And that statement is like lightning, right? Because it's the idea that you were being forced to pick between your two identities. Whereas in all the previous decades that I'm kind of looking at, that negotiating process happens informally often. Sometimes the Irish are challenged to sort of make those declarations of loyalty, such as in the state of Nevada, to establish any sort of organization, be it trade union or be it fraternal or be it social. You have to do this little pledge of loyalty to the state of Nevada. And so the Irish really rail against that, because it's anathema to them to be able to sort of abandon that identity, to abandon that culture. They really are incapable of doing it. And the creation, the formation of what it is to be Irish and American really comes to the fore at this particular point. Now, it's overwhelmingly a Catholic identity. And the reason for that is that the Protestant portion of Irish immigrants into America, and this is particularly true in the American West, they identify themselves as Scots-Irish. And they identify themselves as Scots-Irish to sort of separate themselves from those poorer Irish immigrants who were coming in during the period of Uncart the Moor, the Great Famine, and to sort of also show their acceptability as Protestant immigrants to America to the rest of American society, right? We're not one of the sort of suspicious or possibly disloyal Catholic immigrants. But through that sort of abandonment of the hyphenated Irish American identity, the Irish Catholic immigrants come in, and they sort of are the ones that are responsible really for forging that idea and forging the idea that you can be both identities. You don't necessarily need to be white, Anglo-Saxon and Protestant to be a loyal citizen of the United States. And so if you're looking at, you know, an awful lot of these documents that citizens have to sign, an awful lot of them are talking about, you know, foreign potentate, that you must pledge your loyalty to the United States. And there's this perception that, you know, that other ethnic groups, other religious groups, in particular Catholics, are in some way disloyal to the idea of America, which I kind of already talked about, you know, is vaguely preposterous. The Irish and their perception of the United States, you know, in particular, sort of as having being the earlier successors in their victory during the War of Independence against Britain. You know, the Irish saw, like, well, they managed it a few hundred years before us, but, you know, this is an ally on our side. They don't see it as this adversary, but they realize then very quickly when they arrive to America that it's not necessarily this idealized dream that they had kind of been told in letters, and that they had heard much storied about over in Ireland, you know, either through newspaper accounts or through letters from relations, who often send glowing reports back home. And that often leads actually to a disillusion amongst many Irish immigrants. Mickey McGowan, who wrote the book Rahamur on Sale, The Great Wheel of Life, which was translated into the English book, The Hard Road to Klondike, by Valentine Ermanger. He writes at the end of the book a very interesting line. He says, "I would rather have seen my children in rags than see them go over to America." He was a miner that worked in the steel plants in Bethlehem for a while, then traveled over to the American West, worked in Butte, went to the gold fields of Alaska. And he was quite adamant that the existence was too tough to allow his children to leave from Gweedore up in Donegal to head over to America. So, you know, the immigrant experience could be very, very different depending upon what happened and what went on at the time. And I suppose there's that great quote from another historian, which runs, you know, the immigrant experience is heroic to look back on, but individually was often a tragedy. And that is quite true. It was a tough life that these people lived, and the fashion their community out of very difficult circumstances.
Absolutely. I think that idea of an idealized Ireland or United States, for that matter, is really a false promise. You mentioned at the end of the book some people that return back to Ireland, and their feelings are the opposite of the man you mentioned there, that they actually want to return back to the United States, that, you know, this is where they see their prosperity and their future. What are the feelings? I mean, one thing we don't often talk a lot about is immigrants returning back home, and then what that means for, you know, the sort of transnational narrative about leaving and then returning.
Yeah, the returned immigrant is difficult to write about because, again, there are few enough accounts of them coming back home. The repatriation rates for the Irish was very low. When they did come back, sometimes you'll see in the census record, you know, returned gold miner, or, you know, former silver miner, or, you know, former Union soldier, even sometimes. When they come back home, obviously, you know, in a way, I don't think it's necessarily meant always derogatorily, but it is definitely a label that they have. Like, you will have reference to John the Yank Harrington out in, like, the Barra, one of the few miners who ends up coming back, and he's known as the Yank in the community then from then on, for sort of better or ill. But there's this idea of you having been changed by your experience of going away, you know, kind of regardless of whether or not it's a year or two or whether it's your whole life, which was much, much, much more common, particularly in the mid-19th century. In the early part of the 20th century, the travel and transport becomes more frequent, but it's still relatively rare. Often what occurs is another form of disillusion and despair. The letters that we have of these returned immigrants, they travel often to the parish where they're from, the locality, and everybody that they know is dead or gone. The locality no longer has any memory of them. One of them talks to the local young person at the crossroad, and they have no idea who this person is. To them, the person is just an American kind of traveling around. And that person then writes about in their letters, you know, their despair over the fact that nobody knows them. You know, this Ireland that I knew is gone. And they kind of contextualize it then by saying that the best of Ireland left, all that is left is, you know, a country of sort of layabouts. So they have to sort of contextualize it through sort of demeaning or an uplifting terms in their own mind. There's another immigrant as well who returns back home to Ireland, a guy called Thomas Higgins. You know, in his letters, he talks about him being disappointed in the country and in the people. And he says in one of his letters, he travels around for, you know, 31 days. But he says, even in general appearance, I was disappointed. The hills and mountains did not appear as high as I thought they were. The rivers did not seem so wide as when I was a boy fishing on the banks. And he talks about this idea of emigration itself leading to the degradation of Irish people. The weaklings had not emigrated. And those who emigrated fled Ireland and were in a way the sort of core of the heart of Ireland. There's a real difficulty for the returned emigrant to talk about what it is that went on with having being forced to leave in a lot of ways. I think Kirby Miller is correct when he describes these people as sort of self-perceived exiles from Ireland and the difficulty in that sort of movement. There's another story as well, and it's a person who arrives back to the to Ireland, and very often one of the traditions for the returned emigrant was that they would bring gifts back home. The idea was the expectation that the returned Yank would be very wealthy, very well-to-do. And so he travels back to the locality and he spends a lot of money and he sort of is generous with gifts and things like that. But there's one story where it's the daughter who's writing about this account. And there's an elderly woman who kind of trips off of the train and she kind of staggers off of the train and she levies a curse upon the daughter. And again, this daughter wasn't born in Ireland. She's American, Irish-American, as you know, I kind of talk about. And this journey ends. They go back to America. And later on, this daughter, who's Irish-American, talks a lot about blaming this one incident for misfortune that occurs later on in her life and for her sort of for her alcoholism. And I found that really fascinating, right? That this sort of little cultural effect, and obviously a curse is a very important part of Irish culture, and that this idea could become so deeply embedded in the Irish American community, not just in sort of the Irish community, and the way that sort of culture passes on from one generation to the next. And the ways, again, that someone who wouldn't necessarily be born in Ireland, but would pick up on the importance of a little sort of cultural note like that and talk about it and its importance in their own lives, right? But anyways, just a little few side notes.
That's a great way to end it. I think that's a very powerful, that's a really powerful image. And I think in general, the book itself is got, you know, I think what people will hear from your interview today is the interdisciplinarity and the depth to which you went to get these voices heard. And so thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow the Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.